Well, good morning, Redemption Church. It's good to be back with you today. Now, when Amy read that passage, I just confess my brain works in certain ways. And so when it says, if anybody claims to know God but doesn't do what he says, they're a liar. Every time I hear that in my head, I think about the magician's wife in The Princess Bride. Liar! Liar! Not a liar! I'm not a witch! I'm not a witch, I'm your wife! That's what I think about. I don't know why. So my brain is weird, man. So it's good to be back with you today. I chased warmth and sun last week and did not succeed. So Ellen and I went out of town, found a place that was cold, like here, and so came back to cold, so why not do that? So it's great to be back in the cold, having left the cold. So, but it's cool to be with all of you because you guys are awesome. So we are starting a brand new series, as you can see, upside down and backwards. All about the Sermon on the Mount, and I've been talking about this, that this is the greatest sermon ever preached by the greatest preacher who's ever lived. And that should cause us some pause, right? Like, if you're talking about, of all sermons, of all time, all messages ever given, that this is the one, that should cause us to sit up and really pay attention a little bit. And that's my heart in this whole series. I mean, this is a big one for me. And I want to kind of start off by getting a little bit of stuff out of the way or a little bit of housekeeping. So you know where I'm coming from in this whole series, because it's going to eat up a good chunk of our lives. We're going to use almost all of 2025 to walk through three chapters in one section of the scriptures. I mean, that's a lot of investment, a lot of time. And so here's some things you want to know about this. First of all, there is no section of the scriptures that I probably revere more. Like I've shared things that I really dig. I love Ecclesiastes. Weirdly enough, I love places like Leviticus and Numbers that most people are like, ooh, but I really dig those. Love Matthew, Mark, and Luke in particular as gospel accounts. But the Sermon on the Mount is my go-to. It is the place I am most passionate about. It's the thing probably that most even holds me captive as a person of faith that follows Jesus. And so with that, I'm going to let you know that I'm going to spend the next year frustrated. And here's why. I will not be able to do this justice, and that frustrates me. Like, I love this so much. Like, have you ever loved something so much you can't express the words for it? Like, there's a certain level of just like, I just can't pull everything together to say all that's in me on this. That's going to be this. And so I hope as I'm going through this and you're seeing these moments where I'm trying to capture words and I can't, it's that. I just so love it and I can't fully say it. And that's going to make it a little bit challenging for me, but I hope you can understand in that why I have the passions that I do. That's the first thing. Second thing I want you to know, I don't have a lot of interest in going into the series and teaching us about all of the details. In fact, if anything, my hope is that I dare us to what we see here. I don't want to just be like, hey, we're taking notes, we're learning some stuff, here's the Greek word, whatever else. Like, I want it to be that thing where we look at this and we go, man, if we own this message, it actually has the power to change and shape and heal the world, at least in our own little sphere of influence where we live. Like, I really believe that. See, I think about how often in our lives there's people rolling in or political parties or whatever it is, and they're like, we're going to fix it, we're going to change it, we're going to heal it. And I'm like, no, the only thing that does that is taking seriously Jesus' words here and implementing these words in our lives. I'm convinced that's the only thing that heals the world. The third thing I want you to know about this is throughout the series, I'm going to use words and phrases that may feel a little unfamiliar. You may like be like, well, that's not how I've heard that word before, or I've not heard it articulated that way. My goal in that is I think sometimes we get so acquainted with some of our Christianese that we just kind of hear it and it just goes out the other side and we don't process it or ponder it. And so I'm going to slow us down and I'm going to say some things that are going to sound unfamiliar, but I hope from that it causes us to think in new and fresh ways. Here's another thing I want you to know. My hope is to disrupt our narrow thinking about this section of the Bible. Because here's what I'm certain of. The Sermon on the Mount is not just a bunch of ancient proverbs that we go, oh, that's so sentimental and sweet. It's not just a bunch of pithy statements that we're supposed to put on Jesus' junk store trinkets like bumper stickers and coffee mugs and keychains or whatever else. In fact, I would go so far as to say, I'm not even sure we should see the Sermon on the Mount as a sermon where we just religiously kind of take our ideas and go, oh, that's so good, that's so sweet, that's so precious, that's so truth-filled or whatever else. No, I really believe that this message of Jesus is God's, I double dog dare you to do this thing that can change everything, that can change the tempo and topography of life. Because in the Sermon on the Mount are values that are, in fact, upside down and backwards. I'm telling you, you're going to see things and hear things, and you're honestly, your first reaction is going to be, that won't work, that's not right, that can't play, that's naive, that's silly, that's foolish, that's reckless to do these things that Jesus will challenge us to. I mean, that's going to be the space we're going to want to go to. We're going to say that's just all about loss, and it's all about being silly in a more savvy world. In fact, it's no wonder in my mind that when Jesus gets to the end of his sermon, he's going to say, this is a narrow and difficult way. It's so narrow and it's so difficult that few are actually going to rise to the challenge and do the same, because when you're confronted with reality and now it's calling you to do these things, it's just going to be like, nah, bro, it's just too much. It's too hard. It's too dangerous. In fact, over the course of Christian history, there have been many attempts to just domesticate the message or to theologize the message or to excuse the message away. But for those who embrace this narrow path and this difficult way, weirdly enough, it is a narrow idea that expands all of life. And in that, I would say it even creates a more spacious place for love. And so I hope, as I'm kind of opening this up a little bit more in a serious tone, but hopefully one that is causing you to lean forward, I hope that we go, man, I want to make this a part of my true existence in life. Now, to kind of metabolize the Sermon on the Mount for us, I kind of want us to ingest it in layers, right? Kind of the macro and micronutrients that it's kind of all in there. And so as we go through this for the next year, a couple of things that I want you to be thinking about as far as maybe a way for you to take in more than just maybe reading the message, right? So first is going to be on Sundays when you're here, fantastic. If you miss a Sunday, I almost never say, hey, do me a favor, go back and listen. But I'm going to encourage you to go back and listen. So that's just one layer, man. Try not to miss an installment, because Jesus has got a lot of stuff packed into these three chapters. And so I want to make sure you're getting that. That's the first thing. The second thing is you're going to see throughout the series, I'm going to lean heavily into another resource, actually based out of Portland, which is the Bible Project. I don't know if you've ever come across it. They have great resources and everything else. And last year, they did an entire year in the Sermon on the Mount. I'm going to be using a lot of their material as supplemental. And so in your notes in the app, there are links, and there'll be links every week to their podcast as they spent 40 weeks going through the Sermon on the Mount. And if you decide you want to go a little extra and really listen to those, that's another layer that you could add to in all of this. And so that's the second thing. The third thing I would say, or kind of these are like extra credits. So extra credit one is listen to podcasts. Extra credit two, think about like things like maybe memorizing the Sermon on the Mount, like the whole enchilada. You could go crazy, three chapters, right? Or maybe just certain verses, or at least the themes, the structure, whatever it is. Just trying to go like, man, I want to take this in. I want to onboard this for my life, because again, I think this is a powerful message. Another option, kind of extra credit number three, would be every once in a while, I'm going to throw a book out there. I'm like, hey, you could read this. This would be kind of cool. I won't do it monthly or anything like that, but there'll be occasions. And I'll make sure it's easy reading, it's kind of ingestible, but maybe that's another layer, because again, I look at this and go, we as followers of Jesus, if we just did these three chapters, we just focused on these three sections of the total scriptures, it would change our lives and it would change the world. And so I want us all to be thinking in terms of, man, I want to anchor to this radical thought of Jesus. Because I think if we do, we really anchor to it and we stow it deep in us, it'll be more than just knowledge. It will be this sense of intuition in us. And when things come our way in life that will then call us to do this message, we'll be more apt to do it because we remember, oh, that's right, that's what Jesus said to do here. And my nature wants to do this, but Jesus calls me to do that, and I'm going to do that thing because, man, that is where life is better because it's with him, and it's him working through me. So, again, there is kind of a preamble to the series, but it's one that, again, I am genuinely excited about. And so right now, I want to remind you that we do have an app with notes. All the links are going to be in there today. Even today, it's going to be like, remember when you were a kid in school and you would go and it was going to be movie day? And you're like, oh, we get a movie. It's not just class. Three movies today. We're going to have three little clips today as well from the Bible Project to give us some structure to all of this. And so, again, even that's at the end of the notes. So if you want to look at those again after today, that's awesome as well. But I'm going to pray for us, get us ready, and then we're just jumping right in. We're going after it with an introduction today. So, Jesus, I thank you. I thank you that you personally came into the world. So God on a throne, overseeing all, becomes a person, becomes a man, enters into service, enters into sacrifice, enters into caring for us, sharing with us, teaching us, and deploying us. And I pray that from that we will lean in and sit up for what it is you have. So stir us and move in us and challenge us, inspire us to what it is you call us to. And so, Jesus, we look to you this morning to do all of those things and more. We love you and we need you. We seek you and we follow you in your good name. Amen. All right, so we're off to the races. Now, the road to the Sermon on the Mount, right? From all of human history, there were certain markers and waypoints that were pretty critical that led to this message and really who delivers the message, right? So God was speaking into the world in different ways. So first you had ethics that came from above. And the ethics from above was really when God comes to Moses, says, go up on this mountain, sit down, and I'm going to give you the law. And that was the first set of ethics. And at the core of the ethics of the law, it's real simple. Love God, love your neighbor. Ethics from above. Well, eventually, you had ethics that then came from beyond. And that was the prophets. And the prophets rolled in, and their commentary to the law. So if the law says love God and love neighbors, but the people that follow God are failing to love God and love neighbor, the prophets roll in with ethics from beyond and they say, here's where you're failing. You're not loving God this way because you're failing to love the least of these, the marginalized, the poor, the foreigner, whatever. And so they augment with these ethics from beyond. In another layer, as far as ethics, how they came, there was ethics from below. And the ethics from below is really the wisdom chunks of Scripture. So like David and Solomon and the musicians and everything else. And they're kind of like really boots on the ground where they're showing, hey, wise living that loves God and loves neighbors look like this. And foolish living that doesn't love God and doesn't love neighbors looks like that. And so you have all of these different things. And so ethics from above, ethics from beyond, ethics from below. But then Jesus rolls in. And as Jesus rolls in, he brings ethics from the center. And here's how he's different. In all those other mediums, it's literally God speaking through a medium. He's using another person to communicate. But as Jesus rolls onto the scene, what we know about Jesus is God. And so Jesus is coming in himself. God is rolling in himself. And Jesus as God is then telling us, here's the real center of everything. It's God who loves, God who lives. It's the God who speaks and says, hey, I'm going to give you a new way of doing things. To be a new kind of community that can shape all the other communities. See, I think that's the essence of the Sermon on the Mount. He's like, I want you to be a new kind of person. I want you to be new kinds of people. To do things in a new kind of way that's going to be so upside down, so backwards, so opposite of the way stuff gets done, people won't be able to help but notice, hey, this is something different. And so if you're taking notes this morning, I want to start with this first thing in your notes, the radical context of the sermon, because it's got a radical context, right? So again, in the Gospel of Matthew, the first piece of literature in the New Testament, we move fast toward, wow, it's snowing out there. I didn't know that. You guys are going to be like, we're so mesmerized right now. I've been upstairs in a room with no windows. So, all right, it's a sidebar. All right, it's a little freebie right there. All right, so in Sermon on the Mount, getting there, Matthew moves quick. right? So Jesus is born, Jesus is baptized, Jesus is tempted, Jesus succeeds and doesn't give in to his temptation, and then immediately we're off to the races with this first major message, right? So he gets cracking quick. And in Matthew chapter 4, it says this, starting in verse 12. When Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he left Judea and returned to Galilee. But he first went to Nazareth, then left there and moved to Capernaum beside the Sea of Galilee in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. Now you read that and you go like, doesn't mean much to me. But it's interesting, Matthew has a little bit of commentary there, right? First of all, he says, hey, when Jesus kicked things off, he first went to his hometown, right? And it didn't go well if you read Luke. Like, he shows up to the synagogue, he teaches them, hey, I am the fulfillment of God's good news for the world. And they're like, ah, let's kill the bro, right? So he's like, okay, I'm not going to live here. And so he goes to Capernaum instead. But it isn't just any space. It's this idea of being in this region of Galilee. And then from this, Matthew gives a little bit more commentary. He says, this fulfilled what God said through the prophet Isaiah. In the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, beside the sea, beyond the Jordan River, in Galilee, where so many Gentiles live, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And for those who lived in the land where death cast its shadow, a light has shined. Now, when you're doing your read through the Bible in a year and you come across this, you just go like, oh, hey, that's cool. Like, there was this foretold promise and now it's coming to pass. And so we kind of take a note that, hey, a prophecy is fulfilled. But when the original audience hears this, this is way more loaded than we realize. Like, there's little lights flashing on their dash. It's like, hey, note this, note this, note this. This is an important thing from a bigger perspective. So the first thing is this idea of just, it references God. And if you go back to God's agenda, when he shows up to Abraham way back, first piece of literature of the Bible, the book of Genesis, he shows up to Abraham and he says, bro, here's what we're doing. We're using you to raise up a nation that will bless all the nations. I never want us to lose sight of the fact that God's plan is a reclaiming plan of all things, right? All things get lost in Genesis 3, and when you get all the way to the book of Revelation, he's making all things new, and so what we're a part of is the journey of reclamation. So God has a plan, God has a promise, he's going to bless all the nations. The way he's going to do that initially is through this nation of Israel. And who is the iconic kind of a prophet of Israel? It's Isaiah. And so the fact that Matthew is citing Isaiah isn't just like, hey, here's the fulfillment of a prophecy, but in particular, the prophet who is known for a very unique theme, which is Israel is to be a light to the Gentiles, right? So here's God that wants to reach all of the nations, and now the prophet Isaiah gets pulled in, the guy that said, hey, we're supposed to be the nation that reaches all the nations. And the way they were to do that was to be a nation different than all the other nations. They were to be a people that was uncommon, unique, distinct, and compelling. That's how God sets them up. Here's what we know about Israel. They failed in that. They didn't do what they were commissioned to do. They become selfish and self-interested, and they become just very much a hub to themselves, and they're blowing off the Gentiles. In fact, if anything, they vilify the Gentiles, they don't like the Gentiles, they don't want the Gentiles, they resent the Gentiles. Even though Isaiah said, we're supposed to be a light to them, they're like, nope, we're not going to be a light, we're going to be darkness. And so from that, the Gentiles, these are people that are sitting then in darkness. Because Israel's not doing its job, it doesn't want to do its job. It doesn't care about its job. But now it says, these people who sat in darkness, they've seen a great light. And those who lived in the land where death cast its shadow, a light has dawned. And what you have to read in that is that where Israel was supposed to be light and it isn't choosing to be light, God says, all right, I will go and I will be light. Because when Jesus shows up, he's that light. So he's doing what Israel decides not to do. It's like God rolls up his sleeves and says, you know what? I said I would rescue the world. I said I would reach all the nations and bless them. Moses' stuff didn't pull it off. The prophet stuff doesn't pull it off. The wisdom stuff doesn't pull it off. The nation doesn't pull it off. I will go and I will do this thing. I will go and I will pull it off. And so he comes and he brings light. He illuminates a new way that will bring flourishing and transformation. He's pressing back the darkness, right? With his personal presence of light. Now, I say all of that because, again, this is being said in Matthew's gospel right before the Sermon on the Mount, right before. So you don't want to divorce the Sermon on the Mount from the means and message of how light comes. Jesus is the light. What Jesus says is bringing that light. And so what we need to know is this, and it's a statement that will be on the screen. Jesus, and whatever he challenges, whatever he calls us to or expects or dares us to do, is light pressing back the darkness for all. Right? So Jesus and whatever he challenges, expects, calls us to, dares us to, right? When we're doing that, we are partnering with him in this light casting thing. See, I think this is important because, again, if we're getting ready to go from this statement to the Sermon on the Mount, it's making sure that we realize that, hey, whatever's in that message, that sermon is the way of bringing light. Right? Even in the message, he's going to say, hey, you all, if you follow me, you're the light of the world. But the way we do that light-bearing thing is we're living what he wants us to live. We're doing what he wants us to do. And it's going to be a radical idea. And it's radical not just because of its content. It's also radical because of who he pulls around himself, right? That's the second thing in your notes. It is a ragamuffin group, a ragamuffin bunch of recipients to the sermon. So Matthew is continuing in this. It says, Jesus traveled throughout the region of Galilee, teaching in the synagogues and announcing the good news about the kingdom. And he healed every kind of disease and illness. So news about him spread as far as Syria, and people soon began bringing him all who were sick, whatever their sickness was or disease, if they were demon-possessed or epileptic or paralyzed or whatever, he healed them all. Now we tend to read this again and go like, sweet, Jesus did miraculous stuff. That's awesome. But Matthew has loaded this with buzzwords again, right? He's alerting us to the idea that what Jesus is about is upside down and backwards from expected norms, the way business gets done. Now, you'll notice in the passage it said that Jesus was going to the synagogues, right? He was. Here's what we know when we read through the rest of the Gospel of Matthew. They didn't dig him. So part of the irony is God comes into the world, God brings a message of light where the Israelites had failed, God is helping them succeed, and it's the religious establishment that will be the most rejecting of the message. That's irony, man. Like the people that studied the scriptures, the people that claimed to love God, the people that wanted God's best, will be the ones that reject it. That should give us pause too. That's always the warning, that we can become so religious, we don't see God's heart or God's mission. We're just kind of entrenched in our religion. So they're going to reject it. They're not going to dig the way of Jesus. Who instead is flocking to him? It's the riffraff, right? You got to understand their world. When people are demon-possessed and sick and all these things, these are seen, especially by the religious establishment, as people who are unclean, impure, unwanted, unloved. They're outsiders, not insiders. They're foreigners. They're minorities. They're homeless. They're helpless. They're whatever they are, right? They're Satan-infested. They're sin-infested. They're sick. They're Syrians, right? The other. Or they're the Galileans. You got to understand, Galileans were not well-loved by the religious establishment because Galileans were hanging out with so many Gentiles doing business and trade and making money off of each other. A lot of religions said, those guys are just cursed of God, unfaithful when it comes to religion, questionable in their ethics, whatever it is, right? In other words, this whole big flock of people that are coming to Jesus are not necessarily the kinds of people that you would assume God would associate with if God came in human form. In fact, the notion would be God's so pure and so holy, he would not hold audience with these people. But these are the people. And it kind of begs the question, why? Like, why are these people the people? But as I've thought about this more, I'm like, maybe there is this reality that it's not just that the message is for them, but in many ways, they are also the essence of the message. The essence of the message. In fact, to understand this a little bit, let's go ahead and watch this first clip that kind of captures some of that.
If you've ever heard of Jesus of Nazareth, you probably know he was a famous teacher. and his most well-known words have shaped the lives of billions of people throughout history.
Love your neighbor as yourself. Do to others what you would have them do to you.
Now, those sayings come from a collection of Jesus' teaching that's sometimes called the Sermon on the Mount. It's only 3 chapters long, but its ideas and images have endured throughout time.
You are the salt of the earth. You can't serve both God and money. Take the plank out of your eye before you take the speck out of another's.
In the sermon are some really challenging teachings.
If anyone strikes you on the cheek, turn and offer him the other cheek. Love your enemy and bless those who persecute you.
And there are also some really puzzling teachings.
If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off.
But the Sermon on the Mount is not a random collection of Jesus' teachings. They've been organized in a beautiful way so that it's easier to remember and meditate on. There are 3 main parts of the sermon, the middle of which has 3 parts, and then each of those middle parts themselves have 3 parts.
Wow, the sermon has been carefully designed.
Yes, and right at the center of the center is the famous prayer that Jesus taught his followers.
Our Father in heaven, may your name be treated as holy. May your kingdom come. May your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Well, what does that mean for God's kingdom to come on earth?
Well, we have to remember that Jesus was Jewish, and he grew up meditating on the Hebrew Bible, the sacred scriptures of Israel, and they told the story of God and all humanity.
How God created a well-ordered world and appointed humans to rule it on his behalf.
And when humans rule with God's wisdom and love, and when justice and peace prevail and there's enough for everyone, that is God's kingdom and God's will being done here on earth as it is in heaven.
And that's no easy task. Humans foolishly rebel and start building their own kingdoms by their own wisdom.
And so God chose one family, the Israelites, and he offered them his wisdom. It was called the Torah, which in Hebrew means the teaching. And beginning with Moses on Mount Sinai, God entered into a sacred covenant with them.
Why only select one family?
Well, the goal was for the Israelites to be transformed by God's wisdom so that they could represent God's kingdom before all the nations.
But in Jesus' day, God's kingdom was nowhere to be seen. In fact, Israel was under the thumb of Roman oppressors. So what happened? Why isn't God's kingdom coming?
Well, many religious leaders, like the scribes and the Pharisees, they thought it wasn't coming because Israel wasn't being faithful enough to the Torah. Other leaders, called the Sadducees, thought it would be best if Israel found a way to cooperate with Rome, and so they became the power brokers of Jesus' day.
Some ran for the hills to become freedom fighters against Rome.
They're known as the Zealots.
And still others withdrew to the desert, waiting for God to use them to start a new Israel.
But walk around the hill country of Israel, like Jesus did, and you'll mostly find normal people figuring out their lives as best they can. Most were barely hanging on. Lots of poor and sick people. Many had lost their land to the Roman occupiers and were struggling to pay the heavy taxes.
They were powerless and hopeless.
And so Jesus went to these people, healing the sick and announcing that God's kingdom was arriving. People gathered from all over to hear his teachings, and one day, Jesus went up to a tall hill and said the arrival of God's kingdom was starting here and now with them.
You mean with the powerless, the weak, the nobodies? God's kingdom begins here?
Yes. This is why the very first line of the Sermon on the Mount is, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." In other words, where can you go and see God's presence and blessing springing to life? Among the rich? Among the powerful? No, Jesus says. Look where people are poor, where they feel crushed and defeated. God's kingdom is beginning with the people standing right here.
I think I just love that introduction because it gives us a sense of just understanding how upside down and backwards this message will be, right? He doesn't use like the starters. He doesn't use the varsity squad. He doesn't even use the practice team, right? It's like he kind of rolls into the space and he's like, man, I'm using the freaks and the geeks. I'm using the stoners and the burners and the dropouts. I'm using the least expected people to make the greatest impact and the greatest difference. I think part of that is just understanding that this message at its core is going to be about being powerless to be powerful, to be least, to be great, to be a servant, to truly lead. Like, all of that backwardsness is going to come into place. And so while we're used to accomplishment and power and security to get things done, Jesus is going to challenge us. And be like, no. You're going to have to lean into a different way of doing things. Because when he pulls together this first crowd, it's not like he assembles the Avengers. It's more like the degenerates, you know? Like, we're just going to take you guys. We're going to take the island of misfit toys. And we're going to bring a fitting, proper design to the world. And so it's this unlikely menagerie of kind of change makers that then he gives this shocking news of the sermon. And I think the way it kind of introduces is what's seen in Matthew chapter 4, verse 17. It says, from that time, Jesus began to preach, saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And if you look in Mark's gospel, he has this other thing about believe the good news. Now, when we hear that, it's familiar to us. But so familiar, I think we sometimes reduce it down to kind of bite-sized ideas that maybe I think there's more going on here that we want to understand. So I'm going to just break this out really, really quick. First, he says, repent. And in our religious circles, we hear this as kind of like, repent, you sinners. But the idea means, hey, think different. Change your perspective. Have this reorientation. Flip your agenda. Or this idea of turn around. You're going this way. You think life is supposed to be this way. If we just get power and might and wealth, we'll succeed. And Jesus is like, no, I want you to turn around. I want you to think differently about the conditions and how we're going to do all of this. Next, he says, repent because of this idea of kingdom. Kingdom. Now, when we hear that, again, as Christians, we kind of, again, Christianize it. It's like, oh, we know the kingdom, it's about Jesus. But in their world, when they hear kingdom, they're familiar with kingdom. They're living in one. Empire is kingdom, right? They think, and they wish they had a different kingdom, like David's kingdom. So for them, the idea of kingdom is just the civil and social norms that govern life. So when Jesus says, hey, I want you to think different about what governs life, they're like, okay, what do you mean by think different? What's going to govern life? He says, well, this kingdom is of heaven. Or literally in Greek, heavens, it's plural. But see, in their lives, in their vernacular, when they heard the kingdom of heaven or heavens, they just thought the skies. Up there, that's the heavens. It's different than the land. But go back to the earliest phases of human existence. Right? There's a man, there's a woman, there's a garden, they sin, and what's cursed? The land. You know what's untouched? The skies. Right? And in the sense that, you know what, the skies have this representation where God dwells, where his ideals dwell, where his love and life dwells, where the land is cursed, the skies are something different. So when Jesus says this, he's wanting them to think, like, I want you to use the values of the skies, the values of where God lives, not the values of the land. The rule of the land is cursed. Every ruling system of the land is cursed. And you're going to be tempted to use the ruling systems of the land to get things done for the kingdom of the skies, but it doesn't work that way. The values of the kingdom of the skies are different than the values of the kingdoms of the world, the ruling of the land. He says, but man, this kingdom of the skies, it's at hand. It is at hand. It's underway. It's happening. I wrote the way of Jesus, his protracted, everyday skies living that progressively transforms the rule of the land. That is what he says is underway. That's what's occurring in the world. Thus, he says, you need to believe. Believe. Not simply believe in. Like you're intellectually affirming it. No, he's like, you got to believe it, which means you're willing to do it. You're going to engage in it. If I say, I believe Jesus, then I'm saying, I believe what he says is true, and doing what is true is right, and I believe it's better with him to do it that way. And so I really believe it, so I'm going to follow through on it. And in this case, it says, believe the good news of the kingdom. The good news of the kingdom is, again, this thing that he calls us to do will change the world. I believe this news is better than we know, and I also believe it's harder to embrace than we think. Because sometimes when we hear good news or gospel, we tend to reduce it down to an altar call. And yet, when you think about in their world what Jesus is saying, it is much bolder than that. In fact, to understand this gospel of the kingdom, go ahead and watch this second clip right here.
there's this beautiful poem. It's in the book of Isaiah.
The city of Jerusalem has just been destroyed by Babylon, a great kingdom in the north. And all of these Jewish people, they've been sent away into exile, but a few remained in the city. And they're left wondering, what just happened? Has our God abandoned us?
Right, because Jerusalem was supposed to be the city where God would reign over the world to bring peace and blessing to everyone.
Now, Isaiah had been saying that Jerusalem's destruction was a mess of Israel's own making. They had turned away from their God, become corrupt, and so their city and their temple were destroyed.
Yeah, everything seems lost.
But the poem goes on. There's a watchman on the city walls. And far out on the hills, we see a messenger, and he's running towards the city. He's running, and he's shouting, "Good news!" And Isaiah says, "How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news."
Beautiful feet?
Yes. The feet are beautiful because they're carrying a beautiful message.
What's the message?
That despite Jerusalem's destruction, Israel's God still reigns as king, and that God himself is going to one day return to this city, take up his throne, and bring peace.
And the watchmen sing for joy because of the good news that their God still reigns.
Now, in the New Testament, we find this same phrase, the good news. It's the Greek word euangelion, and it's also sometimes translated with the word gospel.
Yeah, so when Christians say, "Do you believe the gospel?" they mean, "Do you believe the news?"
But not just any news. In the Bible, this phrase is always about the announcement of the reign of a new king. And in the New Testament, the Gospels use this phrase to summarize all of Jesus' teachings. They say that he went about proclaiming the good news of God's kingdom.
So Jesus saw himself as the messenger, bringing the news that God reigns.
Yes, but the way that he described God's reign, it surprised everybody. I mean, think, a powerful, successful kingdom. It needs to be strong, able to impose its will, able to defeat its enemies. But Jesus said the greatest person in God's kingdom was the weakest, the one who loves and who serves the poor. And he said that you live under God's reign when you respond to evil by loving your enemies and forgiving them and seeking peace. This is an upside-down kingdom.
Now, Jesus also said that this kingdom was arriving with him.
Yeah, so for example, there's this really interesting story where there's a high-ranking Roman officer, and he comes to Jesus begging him to heal his servant. And he even calls Jesus his Lord, acknowledging that Jesus is his authority. Jesus praises this man for recognizing what no one else yet had, that not only was Jesus announcing God's kingdom, he was the king.
And so the word gets out that this Jewish man from Galilee is talking and acting like he's the king of Israel. He's appointing 12 disciples, which are an image of Israel's 12 tribes. He's healing people, forgiving people their sins.
And all of this so threatened Israel's leaders that they finally decide to have him killed. And Jesus let them.
Yeah, which is a weird thing to do if you're trying to become king.
That's right. But for Jesus, this is what had to happen. Jesus saw the sin and the devastation of his people Israel as just one small part of the entire human condition. How all humanity has rebelled against God, resulting in the tragedy and devastation of our whole world. And so how is God going to bring his reign over such a world? Jesus believed it would be through an act of sacrificial love for his enemies. This is why in the Gospels, Jesus' crucifixion is depicted as his enthronement as the king of the Jews.
Yeah, he receives a crown. He also receives a robe.
He's exalted up, not onto a throne, but onto the cross.
How beautiful are the feet that bring good news.
And the good news now is that Jesus has defeated death and that he reigns as king. That he's dealt with our sin and corruption himself, and that he's conquered it with his life and with his love.
And then Jesus sends his followers to go out and keep announcing this good news of the upside-down kingdom.
And to invite everyone to give their allegiance to him, the king who defeated death with his love.
The first time I saw that man, I bawled my eyes out. And then the second time, I cried again. Third time, I cried again. I cry almost every time I watch that. And I think I do because then I go, when Jesus says, repent, think different, I go, that's how different he wants me to think. I mean, that's a radical difference. And he's like, but that's the only way that we can make a difference. That's going to be the hardest thing, I think, to embrace in the entire series, is that it will challenge if we really believe it. Like, we want to affirm it, we want to memorize it, but do we really believe it? This week, I wrote the statement, it's on the screen, the good news of Jesus' light-unleashing way of the skies is sacrificially doing life upside down and backwards from the norm through uncommon love to transform the rule of the land. That's what it's going to require. And if we then look at this series, the message of the Sermon on the Mount is the everyday way of the skies. So this is more than, again, just a chunk of the scriptures. I believe it is the manifesto of the king. In other words, these three chapters aren't just like some entrance requirement into the kingdom necessarily. No, this is the stuff by which kingdom people live. I had a kind of a debate with somebody here in the last year where they're like, the Sermon on the Mount isn't really meant for us to do, but it's to show us that we can't do it. And I'm like, that's exactly what the enemy wants you to think. It's just meant to be another law that's impossible to accomplish. I don't believe that. I don't believe it's the ideal for just elite Christians. I think it's the everyday way, boots on the ground thing for every single one of us. And I think it's Jesus kind of looking and saying, man, don't keep doing life the way you've been doing it. Right? It hasn't worked. It doesn't work. It won't work to do it the ways of the land with power and might and rulership and right economics and right structures or whatever else. He's like, no, man, you're used to using power and security and prosperity and retaliation and self-interest and religiosity and self-righteousness and all these things to get stuff done. I'm asking you to do it a different way, to think different, to turn around, to do it the way of the skies and not the way of the land. Be unusual. Be uncommon. That's what holiness is. Do life different, upside down and backwards. And so he anchors this as he goes up on the mountain. And that's the last point in your notes, right? This third mountain to promote a new kind of flourishing, right? So he's gathered the unlikely, he's called from the unexpected, and now he shares the unbelievable. It says, one day, as he saw the crowds gathering, Jesus went up on the mountainside, he sat down, and his disciples gathered around him, and he began to teach them. Now, okay, we just read that and we go, oh, okay, it's just some narrative again. But no, there's more to the subtext than we realize. It's another major symbol of God. Go back to major symbols. The first major symbol is on a mountain. So there on a mountain, God shows up and the law of God is given. So Moses goes up on a mountain. It says Moses sits down and he receives the law of God. That's the first mountain. Then there was another strategic mountain. Jerusalem was considered a mountain. And there, the king, David, God's holy, chosen, unique king, he goes up on the mountain, he ascends the mountain, he sits down as king, and there he receives the kingdom of God. Those are major focal points that Matthew now taps into and says, but here we have a third mountain. And here it's not God giving a law. Here it's not God empowering a king. No, it's God who is the king and lawgiver. He comes onto this third mountain, this final mountain, the mountain that matters more than anything else. And he sits down and he begins to give us what we most need to know, what we most need to hear, and what we most need to do. Right? A new way of doing life for a new community of faith that can then change the world. Here's what I'm gonna tell you about this message, because we'll finally get into it next week. It will indict us. It will. I mean, honestly, it'll indict. I guarantee you, there's gonna be times, because I do it, that we're gonna come across something in this sermon and we're gonna say, nope, I'm not gonna do that. We just will. When push comes to shove, I'm not gonna do that. It will happen. So it indicts us. I often think it instructs us, but I hope in this it also inspires us and pushes us out of our comfort zones, moves the needle a little bit. So what is the subject matter of this sermon? Well, I'm going to take just a few more minutes here with another clip in a second, but I want you to understand why I'm doing this, and I thought I'd bounce it out to next week, but I want to do it this morning, and everything else is going to protract us a little bit today, but I want you to know what you're looking at. In fact, I have a picture of kind of two points of view. Right? And you'll notice there in the one overhead shot, that little dot there is exactly that sign for historic Duval. And over the next year, we're going to be meandering the streets of the Sermon on the Mount. But I think for you to get kind of where it's going, you want the big aerial view. And so I'm going to show you this one last video that gives you the big picture. But I want you to be processing like, okay, this is where it's going, this is what it's saying, and this is where it's going to challenge. But if I lean into it, if I do it, if I love it, if I live it, this is what Jesus says will change the world. Let's go ahead and watch this final overview.
The Gospel of Matthew is one of the earliest accounts of Jesus of Nazareth.
And in chapters 5 through 7, we find a collection of Jesus' most well-known teachings, often called the Sermon on the Mount. Here we learn what Jesus means when he announces that the kingdom of the skies has come near, and what it looks like to participate in God's kingdom. The whole sermon has been given a three-part shape. There's the introduction, then the large main body, and then the conclusion. The introduction announces the surprising, counterintuitive identity of those who are part of God's kingdom. Then comes the main body of teaching where Jesus explores what he means when he calls his followers to be righteous.
What does he mean by righteousness?
Righteousness is about living in right relationship with God and with others. It's a character trait that creates justice and peace in the world. And the body of the sermon is like Jesus' manifesto on righteousness, examined from three angles and three big parts. How this righteousness relates to the Torah, how this righteousness relates to religious practices of his day, and how this righteousness is expressed in our relationships with God and with neighbor. Finally, Jesus concludes the sermon by calling people to make a choice about how they're going to respond.
Okay, I see it. Three main parts of this whole sermon, and the middle part itself has three parts.
Right. And then every one of these parts itself has three parts. There is a lot of design in the structure of the Sermon on the Mount, and we're going to go over all of it. In the introduction, Jesus offers a surprise announcement to the people standing in front of him. They are invited to experience the good life of God's kingdom. He first offers nine sayings that redefine who is experiencing the good life, commonly called the Beatitudes. Here, we learn that those entering God's kingdom first are the lowly outsiders who hunger for righteousness and suffer as peacemakers.
Next, Jesus calls his followers salt of the land. What's this all about?
In the Hebrew scriptures, salt is a symbol of God's long-lasting covenant relationship with Israel. So Jesus is claiming that he and his followers are carrying Israel's covenant relationship to its fulfillment.
Next, Jesus calls them the light of the world and a city set up on a mountain.
Jesus is referencing here a promise from the prophet Isaiah that one day the inhabitants of Jerusalem would reflect God's light, peace, and blessing out to all the world.
So Jesus is saying that he and his followers are fulfilling that promise.
Right. And how they go about doing that is what the rest of the Sermon on the Mount is all about.
Now, in the main body of the sermon, Jesus calls his followers to do righteousness.
Righteousness means living in right relationship with God and with others. And Jesus explores his vision of righteousness from three perspectives, resulting in three big parts to the main body of the sermon.
The first perspective is that his teachings about righteousness fulfill the Torah and prophets. What does this mean?
Well, the Torah and prophets refer to the Hebrew scriptures. And this big idea that Jesus fulfills them, it's unpacked in three parts. First, Jesus claims that he's not setting aside the laws of the Torah. Rather, he's bringing Israel's story and all of its laws to their completion. Next, Jesus offers six case studies of how his righteousness fulfills the Torah. He explores the topics of anger, lust, divorce, telling the truth, revenge, and enemy love. Finally, Jesus sums up this way of life as teleos, a Greek word that means complete or whole. The purpose of the Torah is to teach people God's wisdom so they can become mature, whole people who spread God's blessing to the world. And this call to become whole or complete links back to this section's beginning, where Jesus claims that living by his teachings will fulfill the Torah and the prophets.
Next, Jesus looks at how his righteousness relates to the religious practices of his day. Now, this section has three parts.
Right. In the first part, Jesus claims that living in right relationship with God and others results in a reward. But be careful, Jesus says, because if you're doing your righteousness to get public praise, then you'll miss out on the real reward that God has in store.
Next, Jesus gives three examples of how religious devotion can go sideways. His examples are generosity to the poor, prayer, and fasting.
In each of these, Jesus challenges his followers to express their devotion to God in subtle ways that don't attract attention. Then he completes this section by teaching about what the real reward is.
Yeah, he says, don't store up for yourself treasure on the land, but store up for yourself treasure in the sky. So what is the sky treasure?
Well, this idea of treasure links back to Jesus' opening claim that true righteousness brings a reward. The greatest treasure is not admiration from people. Rather, the real reward is knowing and being known by the loving God of the universe.
And that leaves this third and final perspective, how doing righteousness affects our relationship with God and neighbor.
Now, this section itself has three parts. First, Jesus talks about money and possessions.
Why start with money?
Well, our stuff tends to claim our allegiance and causes us to worry. And so our relationship to our stuff can be one of the biggest obstacles to healthy relationships with God and with other people.
Jesus teaches, don't store up your stuff on the land. Rather, store up treasure in the sky.
Then Jesus gives two parables. One is about two kinds of eyes you can have, a healthy, generous eye or an evil, stingy eye. The second parable focuses on two masters you can serve, God or money. Then Jesus gives a beautiful homily about worry. Why chase after security from things that are ultimately insecure? Jesus invites us to trust the generous God of creation who cares about us more than we can imagine.
That's the first part. Next, Jesus directly addresses our relationship with God and neighbor.
Yeah, this section begins with, do not judge others, or you too will be judged. Then come two more parables, another about eyes, how you shouldn't try to remove a speck out of someone else's eye.
When you have a log in your own.
Then comes a parable about not tossing holy pearls to pigs and dogs. It's a riddle with multiple meanings, but essentially it's about using discernment when we try to help and correct others. Then, because relationships are so complex, Jesus encourages his disciples to ask God for the wisdom they need. Ask, seek, and knock, and the door will be opened for you.
This section of the Sermon on the Mount ends with the golden rule. Do to others what you want them to do to you.
Jesus says that this simple teaching is what the Torah and prophets are all about. And so the golden rule concludes the third perspective on doing righteousness. And it also links us back to the opening of the main body of the sermon, where Jesus said he came to bring the Torah and prophets to their completion.
Finally, we're gonna look at the last major section of the sermon, the conclusion.
Here, Jesus places a choice in front of his listeners about how they're going to live their lives.
Now, this section has three parts.
And each one illustrates this choice with a different image. The first image is about two paths with two different gates. One leads to life and the other to ruin. Second is about discerning between two kinds of leaders who claim to represent God. They're like two kinds of trees, one good and one bad. Not everyone who says they speak for God really does, but Jesus says you will know a tree by its fruit. The last image is about two types of houses you can build. If you ignore Jesus and build your house by your own wisdom, it's like building on sand, and good luck when the storm comes. But if you listen to him and build your house with Jesus' wisdom, you are building your house on a rock. And with that, the Sermon on the Mount comes to a close.
Okay, so let's review the whole sermon. It begins with the surprise announcement about how the good life of God's kingdom has come to the least likely people. And then, in the main body, Jesus teaches how to do right by God and others. And finally, the conclusion calls for a decision. In light of everything Jesus has said, what choice will you make?
That's a great summary. Now it's time to read and then reread and reread again the Sermon on the Mount.
Read and reread and reread. Sermon on the Mount. I know that was a lot, but I hope you get the idea of the template that we're looking at. And so right now, we're going to take communion. And I love the fact that today is a communion Sunday as we start the series, because again, communion means we're unified with Jesus, and part of that unity is wanting what he wants and seeking what he seeks. And so I'm going to ask the team to come up right now to pass out the elements. And as they pass them out, just hold these as they come about. We'll all take it together here in just a moment. But I want you to be pondering, like, okay, this following of Jesus is more than just, I want to go to heaven when I die. And it's this idea of like, I want to be co-laboring and co-doing and co-living as he wants me to live. And so be thinking about that, even praying about that as you go into this time of communion. Jesus, how do you want me to change the way I'm doing things? To be doing these new upside down and backwards ways of approaching life.